again by Benning. Darnell Nurse left it in the corner, gets up center. Perry scores! Corey Perry!
Lilia able to shake away from Solani. It's given away to Solani around the front. Score! Teemu Selanne with the steal.
Three in the face, one. Score! Off the floor! On the board! Paul Kariya!
And we are back with the Forever Mighty podcast on a Monday night edition of the show. Steven and Eddie on the mics. Man, what a game. 48-15 are the final shots tonight for the Avalanche. Could have been 50. They got fairly close.
And it could have been 70. Is there a difference between 48 and 70 tonight?
Not really, when you look at the final score line, right? You know, and the thing is, you look at this game, the Ducks were in it for, you know, the score line was close. So, Torrey Terry's goal in the third cut it to 3-2, but it was like, right when Terry scored, the Avs were like, oh, okay, we're going to wake back up now. Then they just took back control of the game. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a team like that in a while that can just click at that level the way the Avs are clicking right now, where, you know, they clearly took their foot off the gas, up 3-1, going into the third period. Terry's goal kind of comes off a broken play, and they're like, oh, okay, well, now we're just going to put three more past you so we can rest our guys for the rest of the night here and move on to the next game. It's the age-old tale of, you know, one of those teams who's right on the cusp of being a Stanley Cup contending team or you know, competing for a Stanley Cup versus a team that is in the bottom and really starting things from the beginning. And you can see the gulf in class between, you know, where the Avs are right now and where the Ducks are. And, you know, it gives you some hope that eventually the Ducks can get to that, because it's not so long ago that the Avalanche were in the similar position that the Ducks were, and they were trying to build around Nathan MacKinnon and Gabriel Landeskog, and, you know, the pieces have finally fallen into place. But, man, this, you know, as shitty as this loss was, you can't argue how fun the Avs are to watch as a team. You know, it sucks when they're doing it against you, but they're just an unreal team to watch.
There you go, everybody. You guys say Eddie isn't positive. All we have to do is trade away our Ryan O'Reilly and our Matt Duchene, and then someday we too
get two first overall picks, and
we can, yeah, then we can someday too turn into a team with a Hart and a Norris trophy, or probably multiple Hart and Norris contenders, yeah. Quality players at least. No, it's insane. I also think, you know, having come from the game yesterday, I think it's a lot to switch to this, which was such a downer, you know. But, yeah, you know, we know that contention and the teams in contention is cyclical in this league, and we know that the Ducks need to start building back up, trying to get there. You know, there are arguments about which way to go and all that stuff, which we have all the time and stuff, but I does feel like everybody kind of recognizes what's going on. You know, I think... I'd wanted to talk about this Friday and didn't get to, but there was a quote in the Drantz and LeBrun article about the having execs makes trades and stuff like that, where one of them flat out said Bob Murray won't say it, but he is rebuilding and we know he likes to trade for draft picks. And I thought having a fellow NHL executive say that was very telling. And, you know, it makes me kind of wonder why Bob Murray won't say that to the fan base, but at least there is a perception among the people who matter.
Yeah.
That he does understand and appreciate the situation.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we hope. We're going to get to that article later today as well, because that, one of the trade suggestions in that article was about Ryan Miller and a potential destination for him. So we'll revisit that article once we get to the post-game notes here. But we do kind of have two games to recap, because this was a back-to-back, a little bit unorthodox back-to-back this year, but it was the Blues on Sunday night and the Avs, obviously, tonight. The Ducks pulled out a 3-2 overtime victory against the St. Louis Blues on Sunday night, and Anthony Stolarz started that game and actually looked pretty good. You know, I can't discredit the way he played in that game. And, you know, with Gibson down, you can't play Miller every game, and especially on the back-to-back. Stolarz was going to have to get in here at some point. So a nice debut from him, a nice kind of comeback win for the Ducks, down 2-0 to come back and win that game. It's not the typical St. Louis Blues we're used to by any means. They've been on a pretty poor stretch themselves, and injuries have kind of hampered their success that they had earlier on in the season. But it was a nice win for the Ducks to kind of have one of those bounce-back wins and kind of come from behind, which is something we haven't seen for them from a while. But you got a whole different animal here the night after against the Avalanche, especially with some tired legs. But I think the theme of these two games here was goaltending. You know, Stolar's performance in the game against the Blues, and Ryan Miller was exceptional tonight. You know, there's 5 goals on the board, but he had 43 saves. And this game could have been like the last one. That was 8-4. Like, this could have been a 8, 9, 10, 11 goal game if Ryan Miller wasn't playing as well as he did. Like, there was several times the Avs had some chances that were just about to cross the line, but Ryan Miller made some exceptional saves. It was an excellent performance from him, and probably one of the best performances I've seen from a goalie in a while that's still allowed 5 goals in a game.
Yeah, no, it didn't feel like he let in 5 goals. It feels like he got left out to dry 5 times and they converted. I think you kind of look at tonight and how Ryan Miller was able to take at least a little bit of a break and kind of compose himself. I don't want to say like he's like frantic or anything, but I just think like mentally it's very stressful. I think goalies are already notoriously kind of like head casey kind of players because it's such an independent position in such a team game. But I think on top of that, being a goalie for a bad team, that's got to be a lot, you know. Just, you know, you're getting 30 shots, 35 shots every night, no matter what. Having Stolarz come in, and Stolarz has, you know, a little bit of extra energy, a little bit of jump in his system. I think it was only his second career start. It's his first one for Anaheim. I think his only other one came for Philadelphia. And he was excited. He's got something to prove. Gibby's hurt. Ryan Miller hasn't looked great. He's definitely looking to play himself into an opportunity to get more games. And I think what we saw is he played well, and he deserved an opportunity to play some more of those games, especially in a season where there's really no reason to run anybody into the ground. There's no reason to play any of these guys on any more than they have to.
He's auditioning for the backup job next year too, right? Like, any performance he gets now Ryan Miller's likely not coming back. By the end of this season, he's probably going to have done everything he wanted to do in terms of breaking records and setting the amount of wins that he wants to finish his career on and whatnot. So for Stolarz, any chance he gets to jump into the Ducks lineup here is an audition to kind of step into the front of the line to be the backup goalie next year. You know, I think Dostal is right behind him, but he needs a little bit more time. And I think the plan for Dostal next year is full-time AHL gig, where there is no taxi squad next year, and he can be a 1-2 down there with Ole Eriksson-Ek. It's been a kind of a tough year for Dostal in the sense that, you know, with a goaltender injured, somebody has to stay in the taxi squad, and they've kind of volunteered Lucas Dostal for that role. Unfortunate for him, but you know, it is a good audition period here for Anthony Stolarz, because I think he still is, you know, has the potential to be a quality NHL goaltender in a backup role. I don't think he's ever going to be a starter, but you know every time I've seen him come in, he hasn't looked awkward. You know, he hasn't looked horrible in the net. He's looked comfortable, and you know, that's all you can really ask from your backup. That's all we've asked from Ryan Miller, and the team looks comfortable playing in front of Miller every time he's out there. So that's hopefully all we can get from Anthony Stolarz too.
Yeah, no, I think with Stolarz, it's one of those things. I just think you can see what makes him such an attractive like prospect. You know, he's a big guy. He takes up a lot of the net, and he doesn't. I didn't feel like he took himself out of the play at all last night. And I think, you know, when you're looking at a backup goaltender, that's kind of what you want. And that's kind of the guys that you have to hit on, when you're trying to have that kind of organizational depth. So I definitely think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic and to give him more starts going throughout the year, and to see if maybe into the summer you don't have to worry about signing a goaltender for sure. You know what I mean? I think there's always going to be the option, the opportunity for him to get taken in the expansion draft, depending on whatever. And if he looks good enough to be a very good backup, there's no reason to think, you know, Seattle wouldn't be interested. But I think he played well enough, and he's earned the opportunity to be kind of first in line for the backup gig next year.
I think we got to get into what was the major talking point at the beginning of this game. Zegras was scratched in the game against St. Louis. Yeah. And, you know, he's been scratched in back-to-backs before. Usually it was the second game, so it wasn't, you know, too much to read into it last game, where you kind of felt like, okay, they're deciding to scratch him against St. Louis and they'll throw him against Colorado and things will be back to normal. And then we get to tonight and find out Trevor Zegras is scratched again. And not only is he scratched, Sam Steele is scratched out of the lineup too. And the guys who check in are Nick DeLaurier and Andrew Agazino are the guys who check in for Zegras and Sam Steele. It's just become such a gimmick at this point. And then also the Ducks run 11 forwards and 7 defensemen on for the second night in a row too. And Andy Walensky gets in as the 7th guy, which, again, the argument last game was, why would you play Andy Walensky 7 minutes a night when you could play Trevor Zegras out there instead? And then tonight, you know, Larson comes out, Drysdale comes back in, but again, Walensky is still the 7th man of this decor, and it's unbelievable to me at this point. You know, we say every show when something ridiculous happens, there's no way it can get worse from here. There's no way they can mess it up more than this. And they just seem to find ways to just butcher it even more. And, you know, the argument that, maybe not the argument, but the explanation that was given on the broadcast is that they're managing his games played so that he's eligible for the normal 27-year-old UFA status after his 8th season, which would be the 2027-2028 season. If he gets an accrued season this year and qualifies every subsequent year after, he would be eligible for UFA status a year earlier in his 7th season, which is 2026-2027. And an accrued season, meaning being on the 23-man roster, which is reduced from 40 games to 27 for this year. He's played 15, so he'd have to play 12 more to be considered an accrued season and be effective for this. So essentially, this seems the reasoning that they have scratched him for this game. Presumably, that means they can only play him 11 more games out of the 20 games this season. So there's not that many back-to-backs left, which is why we see a back-to-back scratch here. It's getting kind of ridiculous and sadistically comical at this point that Trevor Zegras keeps finding his way out of the lineup because of situations that could happen 7 or 8 years down the road.
I just think we should appreciate this is the kind of long-term vision and asset management that we have been looking for in this franchise. We've wanted to see somebody have a plan. And the fact that Bob Murray thinks he's going to be around 27 and have to worry about that, I think positive, guys. I think what we need to do is start appreciating this general manager group, Bob Murray, really, for having that kind of long-term vision here that is going to put this team in a position to compete with Edmonton and Buffalo when they start.
If you didn't sense the sarcasm before that, you've blown your cover now.
It's one of those things for me that's so frustrating because it's like, this is kind of the one that broke me because I feel like I've been a little bit willing, almost honestly eager to give Akins a little bit of slack here, and it just hasn't worked. I don't know what this is tonight. You know, I just have no idea what these lineups are becoming. You know, I think the 11 and the 7 thing is a little bit much. I think it highlights the lack of impactful forwards, and I think it also highlights the lack of defensive depth. Like, we have 7 defenders, but we don't have 7 good defenders. You know, it's just so weird at this point. I'm not, you know, like we said, I think Saturday or Sunday when we were talking, it kind of felt obvious that what it was Manson being given an opportunity to work himself back into shape with the team. And now I don't know what the argument is.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of joked that winning those two games against St. Louis, Aikens in his mind is just like, okay, yeah, this is why I did it. And then Drysdale getting hurt in that last game, not on Sunday's game, but the game before that, the Ducks went from, you know, having seven down to six, which didn't hurt them as much defensively because they could still roll six defensemen. And you know Dallas Aikens has put a check mark beside, okay, 11 forwards, seven defensemen. It worked. This is why we do it. It's just become, you know, a meme that seems to draw on, and it's so painful every night. Like, you know it's going to happen, and they're going to go to it, and we're going to get the announcement that they're doing 11 forward and 7 defensemen. I just honestly don't know how we got here. Like you said, I mean, it seemed like originally it was because they were working Josh Manson back into full health, and they were playing 7th defenseman, and Josh was the 7th guy. He played like 7 or 8 minutes a night. And that was the reasoning for it, which I was fine with. Like, it's still a dumb decision. You might as well just not play Josh until he's fully healthy. But if you want to work him back to full health and get, you know, play him 6-7 minutes a night, and that's the way you want to do it, sure, that's fine. But now, you know, Josh is fully healthy. He's clearly fine. He scored the OT winner on Sunday night against the St. Louis Blues. There's nothing wrong with him. He's even played in a game where the Ducks have played 6 defensemen so far this year, where they started the game with 6 defensemen. He played with Jamie Drysdale. So it's not like they're working him back to full health at this point.
Right.
I don't know why. Like, there's not many things I've ever sat here and said, I can't really explain why the coach is doing this and why it's something he keeps going back to. But this is definitely one of the first times where I don't have an explanation of why he keeps going back to it.
Are we sure Dallas Aikens isn't a big baseball fan and he's just like over managing the bullpen with his defensemen? Like, at this point, doesn't it just feel like, you know, Andy Walensky is out there against left-handed centers who can hit a slider or some stupid shit? Like, it just...
I didn't think about that, but that would be amazing.
I hung on so long for him, like, trying to give him the benefit of the doubt that he was in a weird spot and the season was weird and... You know, I don't think the roster construction is great. I don't think, you know, he's not being given the best tools to work with, but he is certainly not making his life any easier. And I am just not sure what he thinks he's doing. But I honestly almost wish that it was something like that, right? Like, we're playing, you know, San Jose and Logan Couture is out there. And actually, Andy Walensky and Jacob Larson are the perfect pair for him. So I'm going to play those two guys right now. You know,
if there's some actual strategy behind it.
I would so prefer some just ridiculous galaxy brain ass explanation. Like, it's just so strange.
The thing is,
I don't know how else to say it.
You know, if the forwards you were leaving out of the lineup were guys like Andrew Agostino and Nick DeLaurier to play 11 forward, 7 defensemen, I'd be like, okay, whatever. It's, you know, moving the deck chairs at that point. The impact that Agostino or DeLaurier is going to have over Andy Walensky, it's not a big one. But when the forwards you're leaving out of the lineup are Danton Heinen or Trevor Zegras or Sam Steele to make a change and have 7 defensemen in there, and then just in general you're going against one of the best teams in the NHL, and you say, okay, we're going to take Sam Steele out, we're going to throw a guy who's played one NHL game this year and is a decent AHL player in Agostino out there, we're going to throw Nick DeLaurier on our top line and not going to bring Trevor Zegras back into a game where the Ducks offense has been the best this year against one team and one team only, and that's the Colorado Avalanche. Why would you not throw the guy who can create the most offense for you against a team like
that? Because we don't need
him,
obviously. Save him. Save him for those very hard-to-beat teams like Los Angeles.
You know,
San Jose.
The thing for this, for me in all of this, is, you know, if you want to do this with Trevor Zegras, fine. If you want to not play him and you don't want him to hit UFA status a year early, fine, send him to the AHL. Get him some games. But keeping him on the taxi squad to do this, I don't understand. Like, there's no benefit to this. If he's not going to play, send him to San Diego. You can bring him up. You know, send him to San Diego for a couple games if you know he's not going to play. Bring him back up to the taxi squad and to the NHL squad for whatever game you want to play him in. And work it like that. If you have 11 games set for him that you want him to play in, get him some playing time, because he has now sat for the last two games. He's been out of, you know, game time decisions for the last 4 or 5 days. And I just don't see how this is any benefit to him. Like I said, I have no problems if you, the approach you want to take is you don't want to play him this year to avoid that, you know, the eighth year of UFA status going to 7 years. You know, it's I can understand the rationale behind that decision, even though it's way, way, way in the future and it shouldn't impact your decisions on a young player. I can at least like make the connection for why you might want to do that if you're looking way long term down the road. But then get this guy some fucking games. Play him in the AHL.
This is one of those things, because I don't remember when this came. This came up earlier. I just made the same comment you did. If this is what you're going to do, send him to San Diego. And the thing I was thinking about is, if you just say we have a 4-week period and there's 12 games for San Diego to play and 12 games for Anaheim to play, where is it for him to play all 12 games in San Diego versus 8 games in Anaheim, spread out a little, and still get the practices in against NHL-sized individuals? How big is that difference, do we think? Because I do think we have said multiple times that he's clearly above AHL level. And let me be very clear here real quick. I want to say, I don't think this is what Akins is doing. I don't think this is the way that he's going about it. I'm just genuinely asking because I think it raises an interesting question when everybody is saying, just send him down. Is it better to get 3 or 4 more games in a month against lesser competition, or is it better to play higher competition level games?
I would agree with that, and maybe change it to this. So if they're going to follow this structure here where he can't hit 27 games this year, he only can play 11 more. The Ducks have 20 games. Would you rather him play 11 out of the Ducks' final 20 games and then be in the press box or practice, whatever, for those remaining 9 that are, you know, spread out throughout the year? They scratch him every, you know, every other game or every 2 games. Or would you rather him in San Diego playing 20 to 25 games in that span, rather than 11 NHL games? Because I think when you say 12 and 12 or 8 and 12, it's a little bit, you know, and it's scratched here and there. Easier to say, okay, yeah, for sure, I'd rather him in the NHL. But he's going to play just over 50% of the remaining games in the NHL season if the Ducks are going to follow this, which it seems that they are, or at least they are. I mean, why would the broadcast put it out there? The broadcast, like somebody pointed out on Twitter today, is basically the PR mouthpiece of the Ducks franchise.
Right.
Why put that broadcast out there if you're not trying to send a message to the fans on this is why we're scratching him and he's not playing tonight? They had a whole huge bit on explaining why they're managing his ice time. It really did feel like a big PR move there. So it's like, are you going to play him 52% of the games that you have remaining, or can he play 100% of the AHL games in that time period? I think that's where the question gets a little bit murkier and a bit closer to leaning towards AHL time, even though I do think he's best served playing NHL games right now. But if he's only going to play in half of the games you have left,
right,
and then in the press box for the other half, what's better for his development at that point?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, at that point, it almost would make more sense to just let him either run off 10 games and do it, and send him back down, or to send him down and bring him up to run off the last 10 games.
Yeah.
You know, because I think like 19 of the last 10 games are against St. Louis anyways, so. Or LA, because I think St. Louis and Arizona play each other.
Yeah, like that LA 5-game stretch, I think, has been reduced to 4 games, and I'm not sure I haven't checked that far ahead in the schedule since some of the previous other schedule changes, so it's, I think it's still 4 in a row against the Kings. But yeah, like it somebody asked in the chat here, like, do you think the Ducks have a plan? I think they have a loose plan, and that's to not play Trevor Zegras more than 26 games this year. But determining what games they're going to get him in or get him out of, I don't know if there is a plan, you know, thinking that far ahead that we're going to play him in these ones, we're not going to play him on these ones, and where we're not playing him, where is he going to be? Is he going to be practicing with the team? Is he going to be on the taxi squad? Is he going to be in San Diego? They probably do. And maybe I'm not giving an NHL organization enough credit here on how they're managing a player, but it does seem a lot of times like they're flying by the seat of their pants and they're just making decisions on a nightly basis that don't make a ton of sense. Like, even outside of Zegras tonight, Andrew Agostino coming in for Sam Steele against the Colorado Avalanche. Sam Steele has not been great, but I just don't see the benefit there. I really don't. I don't see it.
There's a couple different things I want to talk about, but as far as Agostino is concerned, like, I kind of looked at this lineup tonight, to be honest, and was like, oh, this is a show-off game. Like, they're just being like, half of these guys are available if you want them, you know? I don't know why else Agostino comes up over Steele. I think that makes a lot of sense for why Heinen has started to kind of work his way back in. I think he's been in the last two games. You know, so I wonder if that's part of it. The other part of it is, it's like, I don't know that playing Steele over Agostino is going to make a difference to a degree that it's you know, it's unthinkable to do.
It's not going to hurt the Ducks for sure. It's not like Sam Steele is putting up points on a nightly basis.
You know, and it's not like they brought up Agostino and gave him 10 games in a row and just told Sam Steele, like, sit there and feel bad about yourself. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so I think what it kind of all gets to is there is a lack. Honestly, the front office just has a lack of equity with the fan base right now. You know, as much as they may have a plan, they have handled themselves, at least publicly, in a way that makes it very hard to feel confident that they are thinking far ahead, that they are making decisive plans. And I think that's kind of what it is, you know, especially with, you tied that with the quote from that executive where it's like, even if you won't say it publicly, well, why wouldn't you say it publicly? I'm not asking for a letter, right? I understand that some people think that's tacky and it sends the wrong message and all this stuff. Like, I really don't care that much, but I would just like an interview that's very straightforward where he says,
yeah,
we know this is where we're at. We know, you know what I mean? And like the LeBron interview kind
that's what I'm
of
saying. He
that.
Sat down with LeBron, but even then it wasn't,
he still
was, there was some hints towards things we haven't heard from him before where, you know, looking at picks and he's like, I can't just get all picks. I got to get some prospects. And there was some like little tidbits we haven't heard before, but it wasn't like, I've realized we're kind of in a rebuild here and we're looking to sell players off and you know, that's the direction we're going. There hasn't been any of that. And like I said, like you said, I don't need a letter. I don't need a Rangers-esque letter or Senators-type letter that comes out and says, oh, you know, sorry to the fans, this is the direction we're going to go in, blah, blah, blah. Like, I really don't care. I don't need that. But there, when he does sit down in these interviews, I would love to see some mention of, you know, the Ducks being a rebuilding team, not what we heard at the beginning of the season where he sat down and said he thought they were a win-now team. Like, that's the problem, is when you sit down and you hear those things. And I think the way you put it there is with the equity that the front office has with the fans right now and how that impacts, you know, our anger at certain decisions. You know, like you know, what you were saying, I don't think the Agostino for Steele substitution is really one that we can sit back and say, oh my God, that's so ridiculous. I don't know why he's doing that.
Right.
You know, all things considered, it really isn't that big a move. Sam Steele hasn't been playing that great, so you can justify it as, you know, another healthy scratch for a guy who isn't playing well to bring in a guy and see what you can get out of him. You know, it's not something we're not used to at this point. I think if the Ducks were playing fairly well and Sam Steele was a guy who wasn't performing, it'd be like, okay, whatever. Like, let's see what Agostino can do. You know, maybe he's got some energy trying to show up, you know, to show he deserves to be in the lineup and be a guy who can stick around. So, you know, all things considered, it's not that bad of a move. But when it's coupled with the fact that, you know, everybody hates the owner, or not the ownership, but the front office group right now, and then Trevor Zegras being scratched for back-to-back games, and then that image comes up on the broadcast and kind of blows up on Twitter a little bit, and you add all those things together, and it's like every little move now is like, oh God, why are you doing this? That's stupid. That's ridiculous. And you know what? To be fair, the management in the front office has done this to themselves, because they haven't given us a reason, given the fans a reason to trust the direction that they're taking at this point. So every decision becomes a little bit overblown, but, you know, for good reason.
Yeah. I mean, like it's not even that, you know, the other problem is it's not even like they can't ask the fans to trust the plan. It's they're just telling the fans, we've got it handled. And you can go sit over there and wait. You know, there isn't any communication. And so, you know, I mean, me and you have talked about this. You know, we talked about this in August about how it's just so many half in, half out kind of moves that don't paint a clear picture collectively of a franchise headed in a single direction with intent. It really does feel like they're trying to walk both sides of the lines. And so I don't know. You know, let me say it this way. The trade deadline is going to be a big thing. If he's going to earn back any of that equity, that he's going to have to make the trade deadline pretty a significant day for Anaheim, because I think it would be very hard for the Samuelis to bring him back if he doesn't do anything, simply based on how everything is going to go. Like with the fans, right? Like if it's a really inactive, like all 25 of us Ducks fans are going to be pretty pissed. So I do think that, you know, cause like we said before, like we're starting to see more attention from the outside media and even from the local media, as far as Eric Stevens and, you know, Helene Elliott has not been particularly impressed with Ducks this season. There's a lot going on here, and they honestly could be playing themselves out of a job more so than they're playing themselves into a job, assuming, you know, that they might be both have a chance at staying next
year. Like at the end of the day, sometimes, you know, the press can be a deciding factor in, you know, either guys getting fired or decisions being made. And we know the Ducks ownership group doesn't like bad press and doesn't like being a part of bad press. They don't like looking bad. They don't like looking stupid. And this is, you know, the first year where we've seen some, you know, big figures in Ducks media criticizing the ownership group and the, you know, the front office group. And Eric Stevens has kind of been the spearhead of that. And it's been refreshing to see, to be honest with you, you know, that side, of Eric Stevens and in his reporting and a lot of other people out there as well, where, you know, they've all been openly critical of the Ducks management staff and their ownership group, which is for good reason for sure this year. And, you know, when you're talking about whether guys could get fired in the off season or in Murray's case, promoted to vice president of hockey operations. I was chatting with a friend of the show, Ken, throughout the week about, you know, those things and kind of what could happen with the Ducks front office. And it's weird that in a season of how bad the Ducks have been, that there still isn't like that confidence that both of these guys are going to be gone at the end of the season. Like there still is that belief that, and that they could come back, like they could be here next year, because I don't know if the ownership group is really going to step up and, you know, likely not fire Murray, but like we said, promote him into a different position and then bring in another general manager. There's no way that they're going to pay two guys. You know, they're not going to fire Murray and then pay another GM and pay two guys for the rest of next season. That's definitely something that they're not going to do. So if Murray is gone, it is that type of promotion thing where they're paying him for something else and then they're bringing in a new GM and paying a GM there. I don't think they would ever you know, pay two guys and one of them not being with the organization. And then from there, you know, Aiken's decision really comes down to if there's a new GM in place. I think if Bob Murray's there, I don't think he fires Dallas Aikens. That's not a good look for him at this point to fire another head coach under his tenure. It really isn't. So you get to that point, like you look at, you know, the Sabres and some of the worst teams in this league and how a lot of them have kind of made moves, whether it be coaching fires or you know, kind of directional moves to a different general manager. The Ducks are one of those only teams that are near the bottom there where you're sitting and thinking, these guys could still be around. And I don't think you can say that from any really bad teams in this league, that you don't have the confidence that the general manager and the coaching staff aren't going to be there next year.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm trying to think about it right now, and I'm trying to decide if I think 2 years is long enough to make a decision on Aikens. And I think at this point,
I think this season it has shown that it should be.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right way to say it. I think at this point there is enough evidence to say that it should probably be the end for him, which is a bummer. Like, I really wanted it to go well for him. But it just doesn't seem to be working right now. And as much as I have some reservations in putting it all on him, because I do think there is a part of this that is on Bob Murray and the internal parts of the conversation and the relationship that we just have no idea about, he's not helping himself. You know, it's kind of like, you know, yesterday during the game, Danton Heinen just made a dumb play. And I made a joke just like, don't make it easy for them to scratch you, right? Don't give them something to point to be able to go, well, this is why we scratched him. And I just feel like it's kind of the same thing.
That's what I joked today when Heinen scored that, you know, now that he's going to get scratched because he scored in this game. But he I wouldn't be surprised if he was scratched in the next game. Because, you know, the broadcast, I had to watch the Avs broadcast tonight because I had some streaming issues. But the Avs broadcast mentioned how Danton Heinen has been kind of an Avs killer this year, where every time the Ducks have played the Avs, Danton Heinen has looked like the player we all hoped he would be. And I think he's been pretty good this year. And he looked great in this game, too. He had a breakaway that got stopped off a good save. He could have had two goals in this game. The play that Comtois made to get the puck to him was really nice, and for him to control that and put that in the back of the net is what you really, you know, all you can expect from a player like Danton Heinen. And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous at this point that we make these jokes that he could be scratched next game, and they're not really only jokes. It could be a possibility because he's had good games, and the next game he ends up being scratched, and it's Derek Grant or Delorier or Agostino or somebody like that who takes his place. And every time he comes into the lineup, he'll do a couple things that I'm like, why has this guy ever been scratched? Like, how has he been scratched this much this year? And the same can be said for Trevor Zegras and a few other guys who've been, you know, found the press box during some of the games lately, that you sit back and really wonder, like, why are you being scratched at this point? You know, we traded Nick Ritchie for Danton Heinen, and I don't think Danton Heinen's ever really done anything wrong. Like, I really can't say, like, I can sit back and I understand why Sam Steele has been scratched, because I've seen the errors and, you know, the progression hasn't been there and he hasn't been that good. You know, Danton Heinen, yes, he's made mistakes, but I legitimately can't sit here and say that he deserves to be scratched as much as he has been. Maybe one or two games this year, but the amount that he's actually sat out is pretty ridiculous based off what he's given to this team. Before we get your take on that, we're going to head into the first break. I'm back again, this time to talk to you about hosting your own podcast with our distributor, Blue Wire Pods. And there's no better place to host than Blue Wire Hustle. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or, if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle is the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to our community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll get you your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and all other listening platforms. And the best part is you can get all of this for only $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge you for just the initial setup. So if you're ready to do more than just listen to us talk about our favorite team, then make your voice heard in Hustle. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bluewirehustle.com/join. Check out the description box in this episode to find out more, but that's bwhustle.com/join.
No, I completely agree. I think I think they said this at the end of January, maybe early February, where they made a comment about Aikens made the comment that he was being scratched because they want to see more offense from him. And that's so frustrating for me, because if you're asking, if that's the measuring stick you're using, I think you're already setting yourself up for failure, because I don't think, as much as early in the season it looked like he just had this random perfect one-timer that we had never seen, and we've seen him make good plays and we've seen him take nice shots and passes and all that kind of crap. He's not lost on offense, but the fact of it is he is more valuable as a supporting winger, doing some of the dirty work, playing good defense, all of that kind of stuff. And so I think, you know, it really is like ask an elephant to climb a tree kind of a thing. And so it feels even more disappointing, because it's not even like he isn't looking effective when he's playing. Like you said, it's just they seem to just be asking him to do something that he's not really the player to do. And that's very
They're asking him to do something that nobody else on this team can do consistently, and that's put up offense. I mean, you nailed it in terms of what he is, and that's a nice complimentary piece to a very good team. And you look at what he was in Boston. That's what he was. He was a third-line, you know, checking, scoring winger who could contribute offensively, and sometimes he jumped up into the top six when guys were injured and did a job. That's exactly what Danton Heinen is, and really, that's what he's done this year. But the Ducks don't have that many players that, you know, that can really complement him in front of him offensively, where he can kind of slide into that role with the Ducks.
Right. It's not even compliment. It's support. Support's almost the wrong one. He's the support piece, right? He is the thing that you put in there. They're like, okay, perfect. Now this is complete. And so, yeah, what you're seeing is just, again, we keep coming back to it. There's just a lack of high-end offensive talent on this team in a way that means the team's just not going to be able to compete on most nights. And, you know, maybe if they were doing something like a Trotz or a Tortorella system, you know, maybe you could say this team could use systems and team defense to put together enough of something in front of John Gibson that we're going to get something out of it. But clearly that's not what's happening this year. So it feels, you know, that they're asking certain players to do things they're not doing, and they're setting the team up to do things that maybe it's not equipped to do. But at the same time, I don't know that it's better if they're losing games in overtime and moving up points and all that kind of crap. It's almost a blessing, the degree to which there seems to be, you know, a misevaluation of talent and misevaluation of the roster.
Yeah, I mean, the Ducks have plenty of guys who are those nice complementary pieces you can plug into a lineup. I mean, the entire team is almost essentially that. When you look at, you know, Danton Heinen is a nice piece that you can plug into a very good team, and he'd do a job. Silverberg, Henrique, Troy Terry, Max Jones, you know, they're all kind of those guys that you plug them in somewhere on a team that has that support in front of them, and they would do a job, and they would look great there. But the Ducks don't have that support in front of them, so now you're asking the guys to do a lot more than they're really capable of, and that's where we get to, you know, the offensive struggles that the Ducks have had over the last couple seasons, and it's, you know, a lack of true firepower and creativity in their offense. And when, you know, the Avs, that team is kind of the perfect example. For how long were the Avs bad, but they still had one of the best lines in the NHL in Landeskog, MacKinnon, and Rantanen? They finally added those support pieces that the Ducks have plenty of them, and they've become a complete team. And now, you know, they're first in goals against, and they're third in goals for, the Avs are, because they just have a complete team. And you look at those forward group, and they all kind of complement each other, and everybody does a role, and everybody knows their place in that roster, and they all follow the lead of that top line offensively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Ducks just have a lot of nice pieces, but they don't have that line. And not a lot of teams do, but they don't have those go-to offensive guys. When you look at, you know, a team like Florida, where it's Barkov and Huberdeau, and, you know, with the Avalanche, it's those three, and Boston has their kind of top line, and every really good team in this league has those kind of go-to guys, and then the pieces behind them. We've got, you know, a nice piece when Trevor Zegras, but he's young and he's a piece, and you need some more guys to go along with that. And that's what we're talking about, being at the top end of this draft and potentially the top end of next year's draft. You hopefully get those pieces, and then you kind of move into, you know, building a team like some of these other teams have. And, you know, one guy we got to talk about tonight too, as well, is Troy Terry looked excellent. I thought he was easily the best forward on the ice for the Ducks tonight. There was a play he made, I think it was in the second period, where he protected the puck and danced around like three Avalanche players. We tweeted it out on the Forever Mighty account. And, you know, those are some things that we've seen from Troy Terry over the last little stretch here, as well as the offensive production. He scores tonight in this game, had a couple other chances where you're kind of starting to see the player we all expected. And, you know, like I've said multiple times, I'll happily eat my words on Troy Terry and how critical I've been of him over the last couple seasons, because he's starting to look like a very good player, and one of those guys you have to keep around. And you can't help but think, you know, how much he's torched the Avs this year, that Joe Sakic is sitting in his office saying, you know, connecting the dots, saying what a nice piece this would be to add to that Avs team. Imagine Troy Terry playing on that second line that's struggling for the Avs right now. You know, take out Brandon Saad and put Terry with Kadri and Burakovsky, and what he could do there. I know there's a lot of GMs around the league that'd be kind of you know, licking their lips at bringing in a guy like Troy Terry and adding them to their roster. So, you know, if anything, he's bumping the trade value, as we've been saying with a lot of guys over the last little bit here. But another nice game and a nice stretch here of good games for Troy Terry.
So, real quick, two things. So, first and foremost, shout out to Cole Palmer, who does the Ducks hockey stat cards. He rocks. As you might have suspected, Troy Terry was in fact the best offensive, the best player on Anaheim by Dom's game score metric. He's the only Anaheim player over a one on the game score. For context, Cale Makar led the game at 5.65, and his average is 1.67. So he really played above his head tonight. And Troy Terry's average is 0.51. And there are 12 guys ahead of him. Cale Makar plus 11 other Avalanche players had better games than Troy Terry. Yeah. So that's cool. And then we were joking about this earlier before we got on about how it's almost like one of these teams is a contender and one of them isn't. And I looked something up. So the Colorado Avalanche lead the West with a 34 games played, 22 wins, 8 losses, 4 overtime losses, and only 1 shootout loss. The Anaheim Ducks are not that good. 11, 20, and 6 with 2 shootout losses. Do you know what Colorado's goal differential is before this game?
I only know their goal differential after the last 25 games because the last 10 games because the broadcast showed it on TV, but over the last 10 games they're 8-0-2 with a plus 25 5-on-5 goal differential, which is just ridiculous. But
yeah, they're plus 41 on the year.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Do you want to guess what Anaheim's goal
I believe it's is? In the minus 40s now, is it not?
It is in fact minus 40, and now after tonight it'll be minus 43.
Oh boy. What was Detroit's a couple seasons ago when it was really awful? I think it was like minus 60 or 70 or something, right? Or it was getting close to minus 100.
I think it was, yeah, it was way high because at one point they had a worse goal differential than they did.
Goals for or something.
Yeah, total points like on this season.
It was bad.
Like it was bad.
I mean, we're not that bad yet, but we're getting there.
we're on our way. Yeah, no, it's just, you know, goal differential isn't necessarily one of those things that can tell you a lot, but when you're looking at bad teams and good teams, I think one of them being plus 41 and the other being 40 negative is very revealing.
Yeah. Well, it's statistically to the first in the West versus the last in the West right now. So, right. You know, this is kind of what you could expect along those trade Terry talks and I guess trade talks in a sense. We had our Patreon show on Sunday where Steven and I came up with 5 different potential trades for the Ducks before the deadline. And one of the trades that you had involved Troy Terry going to the Colorado Avalanche, Denver University product. You're familiar with playing in the state of Denver. Kind of just seems like he'd fit that system. What was that trade again? I know it was Belmont and Newhook coming back from Colorado for Terry and a couple other guys.
Terry, Manson, and Miller.
Right, yeah, Terry Manson to Miller to Colorado for Belmar and Newhook. I don't know if Belmar is coming over now with this fight with Ryan Getzlaff after this game. They were kind of getting at it all game.
Dude, he got a free one in on him, man. I would be pissed too. And let me be very clear. I'm not here to bag on Belmar for, like, I love that shit. Like, you know, it's not like, you know, Ryan Getzlaff and Ryan Kessler or Corey Perry didn't do that at one point or another. Like, I'm not. It doesn't offend me that he did it, but like, I also understand why the dude who he did it to is less than pleased about it. And is like, yeah, well, this isn't going well. So I'm going to use that as a pretense to throw down a little bit.
Well, when they almost fought earlier in the game, I tweeted out that Getzlaff and Belmar are fighting tonight. I had to wait a little bit, but I got later on in the third period.
All good things.
And they eventually fought. So, you know, I'll pat myself on the back for that.
Not a bad little scrap either.
But, you know, to go along with your trade where you had Ryan Miller going to the Avalanche, we talked about that LeBron article earlier in the show. And in that article, they had a team executive proposal, which was the fifth of that article, where it was the Ducks trading Ryan Miller to the Avalanche for a conditional fourth round pick for 2022, which is Anaheim's choice. And it says that it can improve to a third if Miller plays 50% of the playoff games in any round and if Colorado advances to the league semifinals. So piggybacking on that trade and then your trade proposal, if the Ducks could somehow package, you know, Miller and Terry and, you know, maybe Manson or somebody else and bring and somehow pry Newhook away from the Avalanche, you know, that's, again, we talk about, you know, what type of trade should the Ducks be making at the deadline. I don't want to give up on Troy Terry by any means. I've firmly moved out of that camp just based off how he's played over the last little bit. He's really the only guy that stepped up for the Ducks. But again, if it's mean, you know, bringing in a guy like Alex Newhook, who's, you know, firmly a top 25 NHL prospect right now, I think it's a move you explore and one you could go to. And it's one that seems to make sense. And you know, LeBron goes over that in his article on why Ryan Miller would make sense for the Avs. And he'd make sense for a lot of teams right now that are struggling to find a netminder. Philly was the one in our trade piece on Patreon where I had Ryan Miller going. For my favorite deal of that Patreon. I'll tease it like that. If you want to find out what that deal is, you have to sign up for our Patreon and listen to that show. But it was as Steven will reluctantly admit, it was our favorite trade of the 10 trades.
Yeah, it really got me. That Philly trade was sweet. I liked it. I hated it.
And knowing our luck, none of those trades will actually happen. Actually, the only one that will probably happen is the Derek Grant for Jake Virtanen trade with the conditional 7th-round pick in there. That will probably be the only one that actually happens before the deadline here.
Ben Hutt, future considerations.
God, we can only hope. But, you know, we're nearing close now to the trade deadline. April is only a couple days away. Thursday is April 1st. The trade deadline, I believe, is April 12th. So we're less than 2 weeks away now from the trade deadline. The quarantine period in Canada, if you guys haven't seen it, has been reduced from 14 days to 7. So that makes it a little bit easier if the Ducks were, again, trying to nail down, let's say, a Rickard Rakell deal with Toronto. You know, that makes it a bit easier to make that deal happen. Now they don't have to extend past the 14-day quarantine period like they were before. But we're getting into that crunch time, right? And we know Bob Murray doesn't make too many deals on deadline day. It's usually a couple days in advance. So we're...
That's a common misconception.
So he makes a lot of deals on deadline day.
He makes his biggest moves before deadline
day. He makes the big moves.
But he does make 800 AHL transactions on deadline day for no reason.
Derek Grant and Nick Deloria and all the other kind of smaller roster players on this team will get moved on deadline day. But if we're going to see a Rakell trade,
then we'll lose the guys we get him for on waivers, and it'll be a whole thing.
But we're closing in on the time period here. If a Rickard Rakell deal is going to happen, that kind of gets complicated with his injury because he missed this game. If we're going to see Danton Heinen, if we're going to see Josh Manson, if we're going to see really any of the big names get moved on this team, we're kind of closing in on that deadline for that to happen. And as each day goes by, you start to kind of feel like it's more and more likely not to happen. And this Rickard Rakell injury was such a kind of a heartbreaker for any potential trade because that's going to lower the value. But we already knew Bob Murray was sticking high on his price. And unless Rickard Rakell gets back over the, you know, the next couple of games, the Ducks do have 4 days off. They don't play Arizona until Friday. You would have to hope that if he's not in the lineup on Friday, that kind of kiboshes any potential Rickard Rakell trade before the deadline, you would think. And that's a big blow to the Ducks. I mean, we've mentioned before, he's still a guy you can move at the draft, but it almost feels like you've got to do something big at or before the deadline here just to calm things down a bit, right? Like, you can't You can't get it.
Take some of the air out.
You can't
yeah.
get out of this deadline. And the only thing you've done is trade Antoine Morin for Alexander Volkov. I can't see it. That can't be your only move.
No, I don't think you can. I really think making trades is going to be one of the few things, if not the only thing at this point, that he can do to kind of earn back the very vocal segment of the fan base that's kind of really starting to get fed up. You know, I think it's interesting, DB mentioned in the chat, how does Raquel's injury impact the team's expansion draft? And I think that's a great question, but I think more than anything, the first question is how does it affect the trade deadline? Which, like you said, you know, if it's not a serious injury and they can comfortably tell other teams it's not a big deal, you know what I mean? He's gone through the protocol, we trust it, we've been diligent, he had the full time off, yada, 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 then he can still get moved and they can still get, you know, Rodion Amarov or, you know, one of these kind of guys that we're all kind of hoping they can pull out of there, Cam York. But if he doesn't get moved and we don't see him play for more than a few games, you know what I mean? Like, I think if he misses another 2-3 games, especially after the break, I think then it becomes a problem. And then you start to get into, well, what do we do? And, you know, you have the regular draft and the expansion draft and all these different things. And, you know, if you're trading or if you're protecting a player just to trade them, like, why wouldn't you have done it earlier? And so as much as it's the cart before the horse and there's time between now and then, I do think depending on what kind of injury it is and severity of it, it could really mess Anaheim up for the expansion draft.
Yeah.
So I think it does put a lot more pressure on Bob Murray to really make sure he's getting all of his ducks in a row going in.
And we really are limited on, you know, the big trades that we could potentially get, because I guess the three big pieces on the Ducks forward group, I don't know if these are the three biggest pieces, but at least salary-wise, Getzlaff, Henrik, and Silverberg all have some sort of no-move clause or modified no-trade clause, and in Getzlaff's case, as Bob Murray stated several times, Getzlaff is only going if he wants to go, which makes sense. I think he deserves that. He's not a guy I want to see go anyway. Yeah. You know, although you did bring up a pretty good trade of Getzlaff going to the Minnesota Wild on our Patreon show. I'm going to keep mentioning that because that was a fun show. But that was a trade I might be convinced to lose Getzlaff just for this season. We can re-sign him at the end of the season. But Henrik's no-trade clause is a 10-team no-trade list. Silverberg's is a 12-team no-trade list. That's not the most team-friendly no-trade clause to have in there. Eliminates at least a third of the teams that you could potentially trade him to.
But it's only a third, right? It's 10 and 12. Like, yeah, 10 and 12 is 10 and 12 more teams that you can't talk to or, you know, whatever. But, like, at the end of the day, like, if those are the only 10 teams that you had a shot to, then you are bad at your job. You know, yeah, they're going to have to get creative. They're going to have to take salary back. They're going to have to retain salary. They might have to, you know, add a mid-round pick to help kind of offset. You know what I mean? It's going to – Anaheim is going to have to get weird and interesting and – creative if they want to have the kind of impact at the deadline that they should want to have and that they can have. The question is going to be is a front office that has very traditionally been against any kind of creativity as far as roster construction, are they going to want to do that? Like, are they going to be a different people, you know, for the next 2 weeks than they were for the last 12 years? Like, I just don't think it's going to happen. And so, you know, it's frustrating to say, but it's almost the best thing for Anaheim's future could be a bad trade deadline, because if it goes bad enough and we start to really see, you know, guys like Chris Johnson and Bob McKenzie and Elliot Friedman, and we, you know, we start to see him, Bob Murray, kind of turn into freaking Danny Ainge, where it's all the trades he almost made, I think that could put a lot of heat on him.
So you're saying more conditional seventh round picks is what we need?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying we need a lot of seventh round picks so that we can trade them all for one sixth round pick and then take a guy who plays four
We'll take games. A guy who's worse than somebody took in the seventh round pick with one of the seventh round picks we give up.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to be worse than the future Hall of Famer we didn't pick. Exactly.
But it really does beg the question, like, the Ducks are primed right now to lose this trade deadline just because just because it is more difficult. Like, I mean, not only the no trade clauses with Henrik and Silfverberg, but the salaries that they carry and trying to move those out. You look at the two big pieces outside of Lindholm, who's injured right now on the blue line, are Cam Fowler and Josh Manson. Manson has his own 12-team no-trade list that he has to submit. Cam's is basically unmovable because he submits a 4-team trade list. He only has 4 teams that he could potentially go to.
Okay, real quick. I wanted to talk about this because this is a thought that hit me the other day a little sideways, and we might as well talk about it here. Do you think his agent reaches out to teams and goes, which one of you teams doesn't have any interest in trading for Cam Fowler? And then he puts 4 teams that explicitly say no on there? Or do you think they just guess?
I've always speculated that if Cam ever had to submit that list, Detroit's probably always on it, no matter how bad they are or not, just because he's from Michigan. Outside of that, I have no idea what other 3 teams could ever be on that list for Cam Fowler. That contract in that situation, unless you just magically find the right partner there, I don't think it's ever moved. And it's not a deadline deal to begin with.
Here we go. Cam Fowler for Tyler Myers and a 3rd-round pick.
I honestly would rather just keep Cam at that point. And I'm not privy to Myers' deal, but I believe it is still like a 4 or 5 year deal, right?
I think he signed, the 5x6.
It's not exactly fine. I mean, you get a 3rd-round pick, but then you have to have Tyler Myers for 6 years.
It's true. So. But he is like 6'6", so that's
we just go trade for all the tall boys, right?
Yep, that's the way to do it. That's how I'd do it if I was in
But charge. You know, to finish off this trade deadline discussion here, like Gibby's not getting moved before at the deadline. Fowler is not likely just because of that.
You heard it here.
All the things considered.
We're taking a stand. Gibby's not traded. That's it. We've drawn a line in the sand.
We're revolutionary there, right? That's saying Gibby isn't going to get traded. Manson's probably the most likely from that blue line in terms of being an actual big trade outside of Hampus. But again, Hampus is injured. Like, good luck trading Hampus right now while injured if you want to get full value for him. Manson, you could likely find, one of those 19 teams that 19. are still available to trade him to that could be interested in him.
I guess 18, because 31 is us.
Yeah, true. The 32 always 18. Keeps going in my mind because of Seattle, but we're not there yet. I got to kind of back that out there. I'm sure, it's a potential deal that could work, but, what if there's only 5 teams interested in him and 4 of them are on that no trade list? And then you've only got 1 team you got to deal with. You lose all your leverage there potentially in any deal for Manson. And the same kind of goes for Henrik and Silfverberg. Yet their contracts are a little bit harder to move than Manson is. Like, you can eat 50% of Manson's contract if you want. And we mentioned that again on our Patreon episode where you can eat 50% of Manson's deal and it doesn't affect you for anything beyond next season. Whereas if you were to eat, $2 million off Henrik's deal or $2 million off Silfverberg's deal, that's hitting you for the next 4 or 5 years, which is a little bit of a harder pill to swallow. And the only big trade piece you had on Ford is now hurt in Rickard Rakell. And, they already had a high price on him. I don't think they're going to come down from it. And every team that was now engaged in Rickard Rakell is going to say, well, man, he's injured. I'm not going to pay what I was going to pay before. And I'm definitely not paying the price that you want. We'll see what the desperation of the trade deadline brings about here. When other guys start moving off the board and guys like maybe Taylor Hall or Philip Forsberg, whoever, start moving. And if Rickard Rakell becomes the last guy available, there might be a few desperate teams out there like there are every year. But it really does feel like if the big piece is going to be anybody this year, it's going to be Rickard Rakell because there really isn't anybody else that's a prime candidate to get moved at this point.
Yeah, no, I don't know. They don't really have anything that I think makes sense as an in-season trade, unless, and I just think for a number of reasons, and a lot of which have to just do with the crazy situation that the season is happening in, it would have to be Gibson would be the big one. He's the only one really left, as far as players that are questionably in the time frame of when you want to compete for Anaheim and things like that. And I think it just makes so much more sense as an off-season move. You know, maybe somebody gets hurt and that changes something. You know, maybe somebody values someone randomly, or, you know, maybe they get a good pick for Heinen or a decent pick for Steele or something like that. But I really do think that it's very unlikely, especially with Raquel getting hurt now, that a lot happens. You know, I wonder about maybe they can trade Hakanpaa somewhere, or I'm very curious about trading Shattenkirk somewhere. I would be really interested to know how that would go, because he's making less than $4 million for two more years. They could retain easy on that.
And I think there would still be teams who'd be interested in Shattenkirk just based off the impact he had in a good team with Tampa Bay. You know, I think a lot of people can explain it. Vegas. Yeah, I think you can explain it away to yourself that, you know, he's in Anaheim and Anaheim sucks. You know, look what he did last year. And
it's all true.
Yeah. And you retain, if the Ducks retain, you know, 30 to 50% of that deal, I think there'd be a lot of teams interested in it. So that could be a surprise, big one we see. But in the same sense, we've talked about everybody else here. Shattenkirk has his own 12 team no trade list he has to submit. So that does immediately take 12 teams off the board. You look at the while we wrap this up here, we look at the last kind of big trades the last 2 years the Ducks have made. It was Andre Kasha and Brandon Montour. For me, and I hate to say it, I think, you know, I don't want to put money on it, but I'll make my bet this, and that the big trade we could see is Sam Steele getting traded out of Anaheim, just purely on Bob Murray wanting to make a move. And for me, it would be that hockey type trade of him trading Sam Steele for another kind of 22, 23 year old forward somewhere else in the league. Not one I would want, not one I hope that happens. But I think if he gets desperate and Ricard Raquel isn't moved and Shattenkirk isn't moved, you know, I think Heinen is kind of a foregone conclusion at this point.
Yeah, there's no way he's still on this team, which is a bummer, man. That really bums me out.
But he's basically a rental as a restricted free agent at the end of this season. Not a pure rental, but, you know, one in the same sense that his contract expires. So I think he's an easy one to say that would be moved. But in terms of the big kind of surprise deal, it's not a major one, but I think Sam Steele could be that guy. I just, you know, Bob Murray keeps talking about how the young guys have to step up, and if they don't, they're going to get moved. And everybody else is kind of taking that step forward this year. And Sam Steele, and to my surprise, has been the one guy that just hasn't gotten it going this year. So, you know, if I had to put money on it and one of those guys was going to be moved, I think it might be Sam Steele at this point.
Yeah. So, all right, real quick, as even more of a teaser for our Patreon episode, since that was a lot of fun. And I didn't get to talk about Canadian teams because Eddie's a fascist. Let me ask you, do you know how much newfound Fran Dylan DeMello makes?
$3 million, because I had him in. I had him in my trade. Yeah, so
dude,
not bad.
Honestly, a DeMello Shattenkirk trade is fascinating.
It is too. You know what? It honestly isn't that bad, because if you're the Ducks, like you said, just a 50% retain on Shattenkirk. Who cares? It's just for next year. 50% retained.
He's got another year after it.
Yep. Just, you know what? You could even do, we can make this a Shattenkirk and Steele deal. It's a 50% retained Shattenkirk and Sam Steele for Dylan DeMello, and, you know, grab a prospect there. Grab a Ville Heinola or a, you know, it's obviously Cole Perfetti's not coming back, but a Christian Vesalainen or a second round pick, or, you know, maybe snatch their first round pick because they're a very good team this year. To be able to add Shattenkirk and Steele. And I think Shattenkirk is probably the type of defenseman they'd be looking for, more of a just a pure offensive-minded guy to quarterback their power play. It's, you know, I don't know if Winnipeg wants to move from Dylan DeMello, but as somebody put in the chat too, I think Dave put in here Shattenkirk to Winnipeg for a prospect. It becomes one of those deals that you can talk yourself into that makes a ton of sense. I think the only sticking point there is Bob Murray willing to admit that he, I don't want to say was wrong, but was wrong about the team to
Here's
bring Shattenkirk in.
He doesn't have to do that. He's trading a, what? How old is Shattenkirk? 28?
I think he's in his
29?
He might be in his 30s now. Or maybe it's just because he's like bald already that he looks a lot older.
Oh my God.
He's
32. You're right. It's weird that him and Cam Fowler are on the same track and Cam's 3 years younger. But, you know, going from Shattenkirk to DeMello is exactly the kind of trades he's been talking about all year, about wanting to get younger but still have guys within a contending window. So here's the other one I have for you. And before anybody from outside yells at us, let's just remember this is for fun because we're allowed to do that, guys. Would you do this year's second, next year's second, Josh Manson and Rickard Rakell for Willie Nylander?
I'd take out one of the seconds. And
so that was my original thought, was this year's second, Manson and Rakell for Nylander.
Yeah,
I probably
would. But I know Nylander's contract isn't the nicest thing in the world. But you do pretty much wash it for the next couple seasons with Manson and Rickard Rakell's combined about $8 million, kind of making the difference.
24-year-old top line forward making less than $7 million a year for three more years after this.
I think if you're the Leafs, you I don't know if you, I would say love that deal, but you do get some shorter contracts there in Manson and Rakell. And Rakell coming into, he's not Nylander, but coming into that lineup and playing with John Tavares, I think you could expect a similar production. Not exactly the same, and not exactly the same impact on the lineup, but then Josh Manson kind of makes up the difference there on the blue line for them.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then the second round pick is a bit of a sweetener, and they'd probably use that second round pick to go out and get another forward to potentially, you know, supplement the loss of Nylander and add somebody else to that line with Tavares and Rakell.
Give them Sam Steele. They can have Sam Steele. I'll throw him
in. I like how Sam Steele's... I don't want to trade him, but now he's become... Yeah, throw him in there. Throw him in there. We'll see what we can get with him.
He's a biscuit, man. We'll just throw him in the bag and call it a day.
DB Lowry threw some water on our Shattenkirk to Winnipeg trade rumor, saying that there's absolutely no way Winnipeg would be on Kevin Shattenkirk's would escape Kevin Shattenkirk's 12-team no-trade list. They would have to be firmly on that. The guys played in New York and Tampa and Anaheim over the last little bit here. He either wants a big city or a nice, cozy, warm place to play. So I can't imagine Winnipeg is near the top of his list when it comes to teams that he'd want to go to.
I don't know. Seems like the same thing to me. I don't know why Winnipeg and Tampa Bay aren't the same. Hey,
maybe the Florida Panthers, who just lost one Aaron Eckler.
Yeah.
Don't even bring up Keith Yandel's name. I'm going to end the show now.
I won't. Bring him home. Bring Keith Yandel home.
All right. Well, we're getting close to the hour 15 mark here, so we'll wrap up the show. We've mentioned it, 100 times already tonight, but Steven and I did record a Patreon episode on Sunday where we looked at some trade options for the Ducks. It was a lot of fun. We had a couple new Patreon members who joined us a couple weeks ago, so nice to have them out and listening to the first show. We have Pucks and Brews scheduled for the month of April, a couple of them, so if you want to check those out, that's our flagship show there, and that's always a lot of fun. Our Patreon is patreon.com/forevermighty, and we do about 2 bonus episodes a month, plus we have a Discord chat where we talk with all the listeners and have a lot of fun in there. So if you guys do want to check that out, make sure... make fun of Pat a lot. So make sure to go check that out. I know Steven has a couple interviews of his own lately that will be coming out hopefully in the month of April, and then Steven and I are sitting down with Josh Bell to get a early look at who the Ducks could get in this year's upcoming draft. That will be coming, I think, just after the trade deadline or just before the trade deadline, right?
Yeah, we're going to try to keep it as close to the trade deadline as possible. We're hoping to get it in before, so that way we can maybe talk about some of the guys that are a little deeper in the draft that Anaheim could target with, you know, middle seconds or late firsts. Because obviously we know we're going to talk about the guys at the top where they're going to be, but there is the possibility of Anaheim picking up some trades, some extra draft picks this trade, which was kind of the impetus for thinking of doing that and bringing Josh on. Josh is a real smart guy, and he writes, or he used to write at Hockey Writers, and now, I don't know, he's in charge of something somewhere. He's very smart and important.
Yeah, so it's always nice to kind of get a break here and talk about the you know bright the bright light at the end of the tunnel here, and what the Ducks could get having potentially a top top three pick or in the upcoming draft year, likely first or second overall, unless they fall in the lottery. So it'll be interesting to kind of get that look and in a nice break from the monotony of talking about a Ducks loss and Trevor Zegras being scratched and a lot of stuff. So it'd be nice to kind of look on the positive side. So keep an eye out for that. We do have a bit of a break here over this week. The Ducks don't play again until Friday against Arizona. So we'll be back live after that game with another post-game show. So you won't hear from us a little bit over the week here. But like I said, we are going to try and get a Patreon show out hopefully either this week or this weekend to kick things off in April on a good start here. And I know it's a long weekend for a lot of you. So if you don't hear from us on Friday, hope you guys have great Easter with your families. We'll see you out there for the next show. Thanks for coming out, guys. Take care.
Bye. Bye, everybody.